been likened to a pendulum swinging from one extreme to another. Anyone who has lived a couple decades begins to recognize the brevity of trends in almost every realm: fashion, technology, food, politics. And the same holds true to the world of art. This is Erin Jones, Director of the Museum and Gallery at Bob Jones University, with M&G's podcast, Art Break. Think about some of the big names in art history, representing the pendulum of changing styles. You know them: Giotto, or Da Vinci, Michelangelo, Raphael. Then there's Rubens, Rembrandt, Caravaggio, or Vermeer, Drysdale, followed by Goya, Pizarro, Monet, Degas, and then there's Matisse, Chagall, Van Gogh, Rothko, Wyeth, Rockwell, and on and on. And that's just a handful from a very long list of recognizable names, even if you can't picture their artistic styles. But putting aside all of those big names, what artists do you think should be better known? This month, let's consider some artists that perhaps have been overlooked for various reasons. Listen to some of our local specialists and discover the creative men and women that they believe merit being recognized and why.
My name is Amanda Wright, and I am a middle school and high school teacher at Bob Jones Academy. Today I'm talking about Yayoi Kusama, and I think that she should be more famous and even recognized as a household name because of her story. I love how she has persevered throughout the years. She's 92 years old at the end of March, so she's turning 92, and even though she is that old, she has not been famous her entire life. And that's kind of why I love her story. It took her a while to find her niche where she could really thrive, and I love that she has used her art as a means to work through and explain her struggles. She also uses her art to communicate and interact with ideas. She's both a conceptual artist and an environmental artist. Her work is at the same time playful, with polka dots everywhere, but also haunting, interesting, and insightful. So let me just give you a little bit of background about Yayoi, because I think you have to understand where she came from to really understand why her work is important. She's a Japanese artist. She was born in 1929, and she had a really difficult childhood. She lived through World War II in Japan. She was forced to work in factories, and she came from a really difficult home environment. Because of this, and for other reasons, she had many mental health struggles growing up. She likes to talk about how she started suffering from hallucinations, and now she actually lives in an insane asylum. She's self-institutionalized there. But the cool part is that she's used drawing as a way of pushing through these episodes and dealing with those obsessions to help her cope. When she came to the United States, she was friends with people and contemporaries of people like Andy Warhol and Georgia O'Keeffe, all these famous names, but she was never really recognized for her artistic contributions until recently. Her art explains something to us about her pain, and this kind of reminds me of Vincent van Gogh in a way. She started out with her work doing self-portraits. Some of her pumpkin paintings she views as a self-portrait of herself. So whenever you see these pumpkins, they represent who she is. Then she started doing these different paintings, which she called infinity net paintings. And I think that this is where she really starts to shine as an artist, because these paintings are her way of dealing with her insanity. She paints these dark grounds. Sometimes they're dark, sometimes they're light. But my favorite one of hers that I really like is called Infinity Net Yellow. She paints a dark ground, and then on this dark ground, she squiggles over and over, concentric circles over and over, to make a net pattern. And this pattern extends across the whole canvas, and it's supposed to represent her insanity, this repetitious movement, and her just repeating this motion over and over is supposed to give us an insight into what it is to live with some of these mental problems that she's had. She's trying to represent infinity. And of course, infinity is hard to represent. So it's kind of revealing to us how she is coping with these different hallucinations and her insanity. Then my favorite works of hers are her infinity rooms. And she just started doing these in the past 20 and 30 years. And these, I think, are where she's really taken the 2D repetition of her early paintings and works on paper into more of a perceptual experience, a way that we can feel like what it's like to have these hallucinations. When you go into these infinity rooms, you enter this room that she's created. And this is the way that she's kind of like an environmental artist, because she builds these rooms that you enter and you stand in the middle. You're actually shut inside, sometimes for limited periods of time. And the room is lined with mirrors. So it seems like there's things that repeat off into infinity. And one of my favorites is called All the Eternal Love I Have for Pumpkins. And what it is different pumpkins that she's painted. They're bright yellow and glowing, but she's painted them with thousands and thousands of dots. And because of the mirrors, when you're standing inside there, it looks like these pumpkins, they're big close to you, but it looks like they get smaller and smaller, and they extend away from you into infinity. And it's more of like an experience. So you can kind of see what it's like to live with these different hallucinations, what it's like to struggle and grapple with infinity, almost like grappling with how big is infinity, how big is eternity. And she wants you to feel like you're lost in time and space. I also think it's really interesting that she's utilized social media, and I think that has really helped her gain popularity, because once you're inside these infinity rooms, they're just really cool. So people want to take pictures. People have been taking pictures and posting them on social media. And I think that is how she's really gained popularity in the past couple years. So to leave you with a quote by Yayoi Kusama, and part of why I think she's fabulous is because she is quoted to have said, "Polka dots are fabulous."
My name is Anatol Upart. I'm a recent art history graduate from the University of Chicago. I've lived in Greenville for the past 5 years. And I wanted to introduce our listeners to two artists instead of one. Both worked in Italy in the 1600s, so in 17th century. Both have some connection to Greenville, some direct, some indirect. The first artist is Giuseppe de Rivera. He was born at the end of the 16th century in Spain, near Valencia in Gediva. And around his 20s, made his way to Italy, as many artists at that time did. His primary goal was, of course, to study art and to study the best art. And in 1600s, that would be the one in Italy. He first settled in Rome and eventually made his way to Naples. This move was a very useful move on his part in terms of his career. Naples at that time, and all of south of Italy, was under Spanish control. Giuseppe de Rivera, being a Spaniard, succeeded in making very good kind of connections and networking within Naples. He was pretty much immediately employed by viceroys in Naples, and his career took off very quickly. What is interesting about him is that in Italy, he was very much a follower of Caravaggio, his contemporary, someone who started earlier in 1600s, a follower in the sense of painting with a very strong chiaroscuro, light and dark, something that was called tenebrism. In Naples, he very much immediately not only gained very good commissions, but also ended up getting to know some younger generation Italian artists. And for a while, he was considered to be a teacher of Salvatore Rosa and Luca Giordana, two very famous Italian artists of the following generation, who we also have in Greenville at Bob Jones Museum and Gallery. I believe we have one Salvatore Rosa and two Luca Giordanos. The painting that we have here in Greenville is Entombment of Christ. It is quite stunning when you see it in person. It also has some similarity to another piece of his, the Pietà, from 1633, that is in Madrid right now. So if you listeners are interested, you can always Google them and look at them together. It's quite stunning to see them in sequence, quite revealing of particularly these two moments. The Pita, of course, from New Testament story happens prior to the entombment. The other artist, he is not known by any name at this point. We call him these days as Master of Blue Jeans. He worked in northern Italy in a region called Lombardy. And for centuries, we did not know his name. Only in the past decade, due to the completely new attribution on the part of a curator from the museum in Vienna, Gerlinde Gruber, about 10 paintings of this master has been assigned to him under the name of Master of the Blue Jeans. So that's the name that's easy to remember. It's not a first name and last name. It's this newly invented name for the nameless artist. The Master of Blue Jeans was focusing on painting mostly lower classes. Almost all of his paintings contain a woman and two children, a woman begging with two children, a woman spinning with two children, sewing with two children. There is a very beautiful painting, Barbershop. It shows an old man receiving a haircut from an old woman and a child standing nearby. So as you can see, or as you can hear, the subject of his paintings are very much people in leading their kind of common life, nothing extraordinary. Most of them come from lower classes. They're poorly dressed. They're doing their own kind of menial tasks between getting haircuts and begging and sewing. Not much is happening. The most fascinating aspect of this particular artist is that in almost every painting that he has, there is someone dressed in blue jeans. Now, we in the United States tend to associate jeans with an item of clothing that is inseparable from our American 20th century material culture. But the fabric itself has a long history of its own, and it stretches back to medieval Europe. The blue-dyed fabric of Genoa, the northwest Italian port city, in French it was known as Jean, was regularly imported to France, to the city called Nîmes, and hence the name de Nîmes, denim. So the fabric and the clothes from that period were very much a go-to fabric for all lower classes in Europe. It was sturdy, reliable, and did the job, kind of like jeans. The artist himself, I think, aside from the fact that he is a wonderful artist, his works are very deep, insightful, and lovingly portray common people. Aside from that, his work, I would say, is extremely important to the textile history in general, and particularly it has a relevance to our textile industry history here in Greenville. So I would urge our listeners to look him up. Most of his paintings right now can be found in the gallery Canessa in Paris, and some of them are still for sale. So if you're interested, look it up. Maybe you could afford buying Master of the Blue Jeans and bringing his paintings here to Greenville.
Hi, this is Sarah Tigner. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the Johnson Collection. We are a private art collection based in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and we are telling the story of the American South through the art that we collect. We have works of art ranging in date from 1760 to the present. And it is my pleasure to share with you today an artist you may not have heard of before, Lois Mailou Jones. Lois was born in 1905. She passed away in 1998. And throughout her life, she faced quite a bit of adversity due to her gender and her race. Lois was born in Boston, Massachusetts, and was from a prominent African-American family. And yet, she still faced issues with wanting to become an artist as a young woman and having not so many options to pursue that dream. She enrolled at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston, from 1923 to 1927. And she became interested, actually, in design. And after graduating that program, she enrolled in Boston's Design Art School and became a freelance textile designer. And at that point, she started to become interested in what we would see now as African motifs, beautiful colors that evoked North Africa, as well as vegetation and shape and structure that would remind us of the African continent. It was soon after her freelance textile work that she had decided that she wanted her name to go down in history. She said, "I realized that I would have to become a painter." And so with that in mind, she was armed with a new resolve and went back to the School of the Museum of Fine Arts and concentrated on her visual arts career. She went to them asking for a teaching position, but her request was rejected, with the director of that school telling her to go south to help your people. Now, she wasn't from the South. She had never visited the South, so she found it kind of strange to be told to go help her people and realizing that that was in reference to her race. And she sat on that notion for a bit and decided if that was the way she was going to advance her artistic career. She was inspired by a lecture from Charlotte Hawkins Brown at a local community center saying that same type of information. Arts educators and Black creatives from the North should go down to the South to help energize education in this area of the country that was sadly lacking for that type of representation for African Americans. And so she was convinced to head down and worked with Charlotte Hawkins Brown to become an art instructor at the Palmer Memorial Institute, which was a preparatory school for African American youth in Sedalia, North Carolina. She stayed there for 2 years and was a part of the rural community. And it was her first encounter with segregation and racism, which was particular to the American South. She established a thriving art department at Palmer. And she was able to get the attention from James Herring, who is an arts educator at the renowned Howard University. He had started Howard, their art department, and Jones was hired at Howard and stayed there for 47 years, teaching exceptional students such as Alma Thomas, a well-known abstract expressionist painter, Elizabeth Catlett, and David Driscoll. In the 1930s, during her tenure at Howard, Jones was very interested in African traditions. One such painting, titled Africa, from 1935, is a beautiful work of figures that we see recalling the ancestral legacy that Jones was inspired to paint in connection to Alain Locke's philosophical urgings about African-American artists to create images that could help elevate African-American art. You'll see that Africa is executed in vibrant, jewel-like hues. We see three sharply defined figures with chiseled features. There's a symmetry to the painting. The figures have elongated features and expressionless eyes that recall similar visages found in African masks. Also in the 1930s, Jones was inspired to take a trip to Paris. Paris was an area of the world that African-American artists were flocking to. There was a community of expats painting there, like Beaufort Delaney. And Jones was inspired to paint in plein air, inspired to paint the out-of-doors French tradition, and she rendered pastoral landscapes and street scenes. Another wonderful painting, Boats at Teo, is a marine landscape with vibrant boat sails and a gorgeous, energetic sky. On the occasion of her 90th birthday, Lois May Lou Jones reflected upon her artistic longevity and the obstacles she had confronted. It wasn't easy, she said. There was the double handicap, being a woman and being a woman of color. I kept going on with determination. As I look back, I wonder how I've done it. Jones had indeed faced daunting gender and racial discrimination, and her tenure at Howard University was able to inspire generations of artists to continue dedicating themselves to painting and other visual arts. In a 1968 article in Ebony magazine, Jones' creative curiosity reported that she had devoted her life to a quiet exploration, a quest for new meanings in color, texture, and design. Ultimately, Jones hoped that race and gender would no longer circumscribe her artistic achievements or those of her students. She vowed, "I'm an American painter who happens to be Black." And it was her stalwart resolve which empowered her to persevere and succeed. Lois Jones's Boats at Teo is actually on display at the Johnson Collection's Downtown Spartanburg Gallery, TJC Gallery. You can see that painting and other artwork connected to the Harmon Foundation in our exhibition, Excellence and Emancipation. The gallery's hours are Wednesday through Friday from 12 p.m. to 4 p.m.
My name is Elliot Lovegrove. I'm from here in Greenville, and my parents both worked at Bob Jones, so I was around the museum and gallery a good bit growing up, and I'm currently working on my Master of Fine Arts at Pratt Institute in New York. The artist that I chose is actually a group of artists, so maybe that's cheating a little bit, but it's called the Gutai Group. It's a group of about two dozen artists in post-war Japan. So the group was founded in 1954. Jiro Yoshihara is the name of the founder, and then they dissolved in 1972. So the second half of the 20th century there. And it's a little interesting trying to describe their work because there's a lot of variety. They used almost every material and medium you can think of. And yet, on the other hand, there's somehow so much commonality as you look through their work. You can see a shared approach across all of them. So almost all of their work is non-representational. It's abstract. There's lots of bright colors. Lots of it is big. And lots of hard edges, lots of shapes and geometry, and lots of action. So materials and action are kind of two of the main focuses of this group. Gutai means concrete in Japan. So it's very much focused on the immediacy of materials and also the action that was used to make the painting. So lots of drips or records of the actions that the artist was taking. But with almost every kind of material. So some of the artists made paintings by painting with their feet or throwing things at the canvas and letting them leave marks. But some of the work is also very pristine, you know, this very finely cut plastic sheets and strips of cloth. So lots of things, and also lots of interactive installation performance type of pieces. So one of the artists, Atsuko Tanaka, famously made a dress out of light bulbs. And we're not talking like tiny LEDs. We're talking, you know, like huge old school incandescent light bulbs of all kinds of colors flashing. Kazuo Shiraga, another famous example, this kind of fuses both performance and a finished piece. He would make a lot of his pieces by hanging over the canvas with ropes, the canvas being on the ground, and painting with his feet. So people would watch him do it. But then also you can go see a lot of these paintings today. It's very exciting work. It's really varied. And it fits into my personal aesthetic a lot. It feels very contemporary. Like, I think it still feels entirely at home in modern life today. So there are several reasons why I think that they should get more recognition. The Gutai Group was in conversation with some of the kind of avant-garde leading elite art ideas of their time. So they took inspiration from Jackson Pollock for sure, but they also had connections to Alan Kapro, even more contemporaneous, and his happenings. So they were very plugged into kind of this, you know, intellectual art scene of their day. And at the same time, members of the group were teaching elementary children classes. They published a periodical called Kirin, that's Japanese for giraffe, and it's a children's magazine where members of the group wrote poetry and essays for children. So I think that scope is really amazing. It's something that you don't see very often, and the fact that their work could touch both worlds, I think, is really remarkable, and I think that's something that is great to aspire to as an artist. And very accessible in a way. So two really famous things that they did, one of their early exhibitions was in a park, and there were lots of interactive pieces that just anybody in the park could interact with. You know, this kind of box-like structure of plastic that you could walk inside and stand in the middle of. Or a piece called Please Walk on Me, which if you imagine maybe like a narrow dresser tipped down on its side so that the drawers are all facing up, and then you walk across the drawers, but they all have different levels of springiness. So as you walk, it's changing. And I heard one writer kind of compare it to composing. You know, in composing music, we use the softness and loudness of sounds to make a composition. So, you know, can you use the firmness or springiness of surfaces in sequence to make some kind of interesting meaning? And then they also, in 1960, had what they called the International Sky Festival in Osaka, where they got a bunch of international artists to make giant banner-sized paintings, and they flew them over the city under balloons. So there's this very putting art in a place where everybody can see it. It's a really wonderful thing, I think. I think a lot of people today are very intimidated by especially contemporary art, and doing something that is in a very everyday setting is another really cool thing. And on that note of the everyday, I think this is another really wonderful thing about their work, that lots of it starts with everyday objects or materials and transforms them. So probably one of the best examples here is a piece called Work Water by Sadamasa Motunaga, which uses clear plastic pipes that are flexible, and then they have colored water in them of very bright colors. And he hung several of them together. So it's really quite stunning. They're overhead, so you would look up and you see the sunlight filtering through this colored water in these clear plastic pipes. And, you know, water in cheap plastic is something that we see every day. But to take it and turn it into something that feels very special and beautiful, I think is a really important thing. You know, I'm really glad that we have art that deals with topics that are very significant and weighty already. But most of us spend the majority of our lives doing things that feel very normal, maybe even mundane. And so, you know, the ability for art that takes those things and finds a way to see beauty in them or reimagine them and turn them into something special, I think is one of the best gifts that art can give. I think, at least I know for me as an artist, that's one of the best gifts I feel like I've gotten from studying art, that it's like a lens that we can look at the world. You know, I feel like the Gutai group did this, look at almost anything, and how can we take this to the next level? You know, how can we turn this into an artwork? So I think there are a couple reasons why they're not better known. One of them is an interesting question in a discussion like this, that a lot of their work was ephemeral. You know, the work in the park that could get walked on or flown over the city, like we don't still have those. We just have some documentation of it. But I don't think that makes it not worth remembering. You know, do we only remember artists because we can still see the physical object? Or is it possible that, you know, the spirit that artists embodied and what they were accomplishing and demonstrating through their work is still worth passing on, you know, even if we have to use a little more creativity in how we do that. If you want to see more of their work, you know, you can do a simple internet search. One good place to start, there was a fantastic exhibition in 2013 at the Guggenheim called Splendid Playground. So if you search for that, you can see some really great articles or photos. I think it might be a stretch to say that they'll ever be a household name, but I certainly would love to see more people know about them.
It's my pleasure to be with you today and to share some of my experiences with a particular artist, Leo Twiggs. My name is Sandy Rupp, and I am the owner of Hampton 3 Gallery. And last year, the gallery celebrated its 50th anniversary. And that gallery is the oldest gallery in South Carolina. So we're very grateful to have been established all those years. In 1970, when my father, Richard Rupp, started the gallery with three artists, Daryl Coons, Carl Blair, and Emery Bopp, they invited artists throughout South Carolina, professional artists at that time, who were showing throughout the Southeast. The staple of artists that was collected at that time were artists that were coming sometimes from other parts of the country, and it was an influx after World War II. When a lot of artists were going to remote places to start art programs in the universities because of the GI Bill. And so Hampton 3 invited people like William Halsey and Janet Dreskin, and Edmund Yajin was part of our stable for a while, and an artist named Dr. Leo Twiggs. Leo Twiggs was an African-American artist, and it was very rare during those days that an African-American artist was being represented by a professional gallery. Leo was born in 1934. This last month, February, he turned 87. He grew up in St. Stephen's, which is a little bit north of Charleston. His family was poor. He was the oldest of seven children. And when he was 15, his father died. It happened to be his first night as a projectionist in the theater in the town. He was allowed to take that position because nobody would know that he was black because he was up in the booth. He came home, his father had died, and he became the man of the family. I remember his telling a story about his responsibilities to his brothers and his one sister. And through sheer determination and the help of a white minister, Leo went to college at Clafton in Orangeburg, South Carolina. There he received honors and he distinguished himself academically. He studied art and desired to be a visual artist. He came back to Orangeburg, that's where Clafton is and still is, and he started teaching in high school there. He decided he needed more education, but at that time, South Carolina had no higher institution that would allow his matriculation. So they literally had to pay for him to go to New York University, which was really a blessing in disguise. It was the hotbed of abstract expressionism, and there were many well-known artists that were teaching there, among whom was Hale Woodruff, and he became a mentor to Leo Twiggs. After receiving his master's degree there, he came back to Orangeburg, and he taught at South Carolina State College. He had opportunities to teach elsewhere, but he felt like he wanted to come back to his state and to invest in the next generation that was in South Carolina. He decided after teaching for a few years that he needed a doctorate degree. The University of Georgia was soliciting African-American students at the time. They were opening up their degrees to the black community. Leo was accepted, and he became the first doctorate of art education at the University of Georgia. So he's been an example and a trailblazer for many, many young people. His sister and his brothers went on to higher education. They had no money, and yet they worked through and overcame much to accomplish success in their careers. When Leo was at the Art Institute of Chicago, he was there one summer taking some classes. He became introduced to the medium of batik. If anybody understands batik, you know they're usually scarves, tie-dye, things from the 60s, and it was considered a craft. But Leo looked at this process, and he thought of the possibility of creating fine art. He took cotton fabric, he took dyes, he took a tool called jaunting, which has hot wax in it, and after he laid the dye on the fabric, he would take the hot wax and he would impress the wax in that color that he wanted to keep on that fabric. And so the process of painting was very tedious. Leo had no book to teach him how to do this. And so he was also an innovator for many others to come that used the process of batik as a fine art. Once you keep dyeing the fabric, you wash out the dyes, then you put another color on the fabric, you catch it with the wax, and finally, when you have your image and the whole surface of the cotton is filled with wax, then you have to iron that out. And the wax is withdrawn through newspapers or other supplies. And then you have the final product of your painting on the cotton. So this has been Leo's technique for many, many years. It's not a fast working process as it would be with watercolors or oils, but it's a contemplative one that takes time. And if there's anything that I've learned about Leo, he is very cerebral in the way he goes about his work. You wouldn't think so looking at it. It feels spontaneous, it feels fresh, poignant, but he thinks through what does he want to communicate visually, what does he want to accomplish. Throughout his years, he's been emphasizing many themes. Early on in the 70s, there was the mother and child image. His mother and grandmother, of course, played an important part in his life. There had been railroad crossings, the idea of crossing over, accomplishing something that is hard, a loss that you have to cross over. Targeted Man has been a series of his. The blues, the music coming from the African-American culture. He did also a series of Hurricane Hugo, the devastation on the coast when so much was destroyed. But throughout all these series, there's an element of hope in Leo's work. There's an element of redemption. There's an element of a better day. In 2015, on June 17th, there was a shooting at the Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. A young man went into a Bible study, an African-American church. These people welcomed him in, and then he slaughtered them. Mother Emanuel, it was a day that South Carolina will remember, and Leo had to address that in his art. There were 9 paintings that came from Leo's studio called Requiem for Mother Emanuel. This series, like many of the other series that Leo has done, has traveled throughout the South and throughout the United States, frankly. So he's well known in his visual art field. But this series hit a note that none other had. He couldn't immediately start painting. But as the year progressed after the slayings, he started creating 1, 2 pieces. And the imagery that was coming forth in the beginning was the image of the Confederate flag, which Leo has explored for most of his life. The flag to him is something to be remembered. And even Bill Island, who's the director of the Georgia Museum of Art, says he uses the symbol in a provocative, in an ironic way to tell his message of his experiences as an African-American. So he's creating something different than the actual Confederate flag, which we all are familiar with. But the night of the slayings, that young man was shown in images on the press of using the Confederate flag as one of his symbols of contemplation of going after this group of people. So the flag became center in the first painting. The flag started to deteriorate into bloodiness. As the series progressed, the flag started disappearing, and the cross became a Christian cross. And at the end of the series, you saw the crosses, the 9 crosses floating into the air, the horizon. And there was, in Leo's words, the idea of forgiveness and redemption and another world. There's a film that has been done on this Requiem series. It's on YouTube. And I invite you to go Google it, Requiem for Mother Emanuel by Leo Twiggs. Joe Clark and Ken Beal is the one that produced that. And in Leo's words, he said, that was a changing point for our state. We actually came together. What that church did in forgiving that young man in that courtroom was something that we had not seen. And even Leo said, Christ said, I forgive them. Father, forgive them on the cross. And so the last painting of Mother Emmanuel is all about forgiveness and redemption. Leo has a voice in South Carolina, but also far beyond. And it's been such a privilege for me to know this man, not just through his work, which is amazing, but through his heart. I close with this paragraph. It was written by Luke DeLello, who also got to know Leo on such a personal basis. He said, Leo has been told that his paintings whisper. In a still, calm voice, Leo's works force us to truthfully face the evil and the violence around us, all the while calling for understanding, unifying conversations, forgiveness, and reconciliation. Through Leo's work, it often focuses on African-American experiences in the South. The themes he wrestles with are universal, and the visions they represent is one of the South coming to terms with its own flaws and crossing over into a difficult but a more unified future.
Whether or not they are appreciated during their own lives or make the established list, skilled masters are present in every era. And sometimes it may take a few generations for them to be understood and acknowledged. After hearing about these few men and women whose life experiences influenced their work and skill as much as their training, perhaps now you know a little better to be on the lookout for artists presenting thoughtful, valuable perspectives and universal themes. If you would like to know more about the museum and gallery and its internationally respected collection of European Old Masters, visit bjumg.org.